Welcome to Parents' Perspective. You're kidding! Carla watched her sister Gwen at the sink. You're only rinsing those tomatoes in tap water? Gwen spun around, reaching for a dish towel. What's wrong with that, for heaven's sake? Well, for starters, you've heard about some of the pesticides still in use, and the possible effects on children, right? And of course, the soil they're grown in can be full of environmental no-nos. But the kicker is that your own tap water can have all kinds of bad stuff in it that you just washed onto the tomatoes. Don't you worry about what you're feeding Katie and Brad? Oh, my. Carla looked at the tomatoes sitting on her counter. Now what? Seems like everything I could feed them has a downside, not to mention where they play and what they breathe. Sometimes I just feel like putting them into some kind of plastic bubble until they're all grown. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about environmental hazards to children? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest today is a practicing pediatrician who also works in the field of environmental health. He has visited with us before. Dr. Benjamin Gitterman is co-director of the Mid-Atlantic Center for Children's Health and the Environment, located at Children's National Medical Center and George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He serves on numerous committees and advisory boards on environment-related issues and has written and spoken in local, regional, and national arenas regarding pediatric environmental health issues. He's also an associate professor of pediatrics and public health at George Washington University and has been involved as well in numerous seminars and workshops for future leaders in the field. We're so glad you can be with us, Dr. Gitterman.
Thank you so much. I'm very, very pleased to be here.
What's your biggest worry about environmental hazards for children?
You know, I have two, and you actually, this is almost a pun, encapsulated one of them in your opening remark, Sandy. But they're two, they're on opposite ends of the perspective, and we have to find a way to balance these two. On one hand, we can't have our children, or ourselves for that matter, live in a bubble. What you said is so critical. I meet people all the time who really have to try to watch for every single thing that they do, and it's impossible. On the other hand, we not only have to be practical, but we have to think ahead, because my really biggest concern about environmental health in children isn't what we know, it's what we don't know.
Which is very scary.
Which is scares the heck out of me, to be very honest. Let me give you an example, and I think the most important one. There are, depending on who you read, and I forget the actual number, somewhere between 50,000 and 80,000 chemicals that are used in one way or other in our world for many positive, wonderful things. Let's be really clear. How many of them do you think we really know all of the actual impacts within our bodies? In the hundreds. Some people say 500, some people say 600. The exact number isn't important. And that's the ones that we know the individual impact. We barely even have a clue as to how all of these things interact. So what I worry and what I continue to wonder is what all of this means down the line for what we don't know. On the other hand, let's be real. As much as I would like to, we're not going back to the Garden of Eden. I mean, let's get real, folks. There is a world out there that we have to live in, that we have to interact in, and that we want to live in and enjoy many of the positive things that technology and progress has made. How do we attempt to say, let's at least be prudent, let's at least be practical, and more important, let's not always take technological and speed advances and have them totally overtake our lives.
Are there certain ages when kids are especially vulnerable to all this stuff that we really don't know about now?
Yeah, that's a very important question, and it's one of the reasons why children's environmental health is a totally different field than adult environmental health. Years ago, environmental health, if anybody knew much about it, was strictly relegated to the area of adults. Not that anybody wanted to hurt kids, but we looked at adults and kids essentially in terms of what standards, what preventions, what approaches we had the same way. We've increasingly come to realize, and this is a lovely take-home expression that I like, that children are not little adults. They're not little adults in a lot of fun ways. Thank goodness they're not little adults. I mean, they would be a nightmare, you know. They'd be doing stockbroker deals and whatever. But they're not physiologically. A child begins life as the fusion of two cells, a sperm and an egg. And that little thing grows in a couple of years to something which is walking, talking, breathing, playing, crying, and all of the other things that a child does. And all of the body organs within that child's life are developing and have the potential to, unfortunately, incorporate all of the environmental toxicants which that child is exposed to. The brain is developing, the lungs are developing, the endocrine and the reproductive systems are beginning to develop. I could go on and on and on. And the most important age is not limited to the first 2 years, but what's key is in those earlier developing years, particularly many people feel in the neurodevelopmental development years, the first 5 years of life, but also again as the reproductive system is growing before one reaches puberty, these are the times that perhaps that matters the most. Mm-hmm. We don't think enough about the prenatal period, about the fact that a woman's placenta has very few barriers to the things that she's exposed to, and therefore, whereas the woman herself usually may be safe, the impact on her baby is quite important. And so when one thinks about children's environmental health, we have to really think from preconception and conception going up all the way through.
One of the most interesting things to me watching two daughters-in-law become pregnant, I saw them doing things, eating things, being aware of things that never occurred to us when I was having my children 30-some years ago. For example, they're all sushi lovers. No raw sushi, of course, during the pregnancy time. Certain kinds of cheeses, never would have occurred to me that there were certain kinds of cheeses I could have and not have. They have a rule in one of my son's homes where you have to take your shoes off when you come in the house. We thought that was because they had had all the floors redone in this very old house. They had no children when we were first told that
right.
you had to take your shoes off, so
right.
that was a logical
right.
thing to figure out. Well, it turns out they didn't want the lead soil
right.
tracked all over their
right.
house.
Right.
So.
I think you're bringing up something critical. I think you're bringing up the change in the public's perspective
yes.
on this. And you're right. I used to see, in my work as a pediatrician, I used to see the area of children's environmental health in the purview of the granola heads, the Birkenstock Berkeleyites, or whatever else you want to call it. It was a very small, select group of people who, to their credit, were thinking about these issues. So that's why I'm not calling it pejorative. And where would they buy their fruits and vegetables? They would buy them in these little tiny natural or organic food stores that always had bad lighting, wood floors. The fruits and vegetables that you could buy unequivocally were what they said they were. They were gnarled. They were ugly. They were amazingly unappetizing. And you would say, ew, what a thought. Isn't that the stereotype that
Absolutely.
You have?
Absolutely, I remember that.
Look where we are now. The major large supermarkets, which have now proliferated around the United States, but the major markets like that, which are now in many, many places, are actually slightly beginning to lose market share because the larger traditional chains are finally mm-hmm. stocking organics and the like and natural foods, and where they have sections, not one little item before.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on kids and environmental hazards.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Ben Gitterman about environmental hazards to children.
Parents ask me questions about this stuff from all walks of life. I'm very lucky in my role as a general pediatrician that I see kids from all socioeconomic strata, from all ethnic and racial backgrounds, and the whole range. It's not that small select population anymore who asks me about these things. It's people across the board. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about in my role as an environmentalist. I'm talking in my role as a general pediatrician. It's astounding how the public is beginning to become aware of this. If the field of pediatric environmental health or children's environmental health was in its infancy, the last time that you had a program on this, we can comfortably say that it's now moving into its toddlerhood.
Well, it's interesting because one of our guests at that time said, if nothing else, buy organic products because of your grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, how interesting. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to support the market so that it could do what it's doing now.
Exactly.
Which is proliferating.
This is the progress I was talking about. On the other hand, we have to be really careful because where there's a market, there's a price.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to make sure not to make people feel bad. We have to recognize the fact that to turn your diet into an entirely or an essentially or an almost entirely organic diet costs a lot of money. And many people can't afford mm-hmm. that. So we have to be pragmatic. And we have to stop and not make people feel bad if they can't do it. Right. I think it's important, again, this is the pragmatism. This is the taking this in moderation to a degree and say to work towards that in that direction, but not to feel bad if you can't do that under every circumstance. But it seems to me that organic, given the fact that it can only help, and that as I talked about, the things that we don't know, to move further and further away from the use of pesticides, of hormones, of a variety of treated things, can only be to a child's benefit, and it certainly can't possibly hurt them, that it ought to be a goal, and it would be one place that we should set our priorities, as opposed to seeing how much money we can spend on complex toys, on things with a million parts for the small child who in reality is satisfied
with blocks.
By many simpler things. I mean, I'll give parents a little more credit than that. They don't have to live only with boxes and that. But it's amazing how you can watch a child be content with rattling a piece of paper for ages on end and does not need the $200 this or that.
What are the most significant environmental hazards for kids as we begin the 21st century?
There are a couple of additional things that are really important to think about. One that we can do something directly about and one that we can't. Obesity in children. Mm-hmm. That's an environmental related issue. It's inevitable that all of obesity is not caused by portion size. Some of it is. It's also caused by what we eat. And when you're dealing with fast foods and processed foods, all of the things that are in those foods. That's a major environmental issue. The next and the other most significant environmental hazard for kids and for us is the area of global warming. We've lost our perspective if we're not thinking about that. And it's unfortunately garbage to say that's not my problem. That's a problem of government and regulation. That's an issue for everyone. It becomes relevant for us as being informed individuals to know that this stuff is real, to not bury our head in the sands. Lastly, it's important to consider the things that we do in our day-to-day life, whether it be, you know, whether it be driving, whether it be emissions, whether it be the sources of energy that we use, which really can make a difference for the kids that we're involved with, the kids that we're raising, and the kids that we care for and care about.
I saw a New Yorker cartoon the other day that showed a woman and a child on an elevator.
Yeah.
And you look at it and you think, what is the comment it's meant to make? And then you notice that the woman has her hand down right next to the child with a cigarette.
Mm.
A cigarette with the smoke going up to the child. Oh, it was right at the child's breathing level.
Right.
And I thought, oh, what a fabulous commentary this
is. Right.
Scary, though.
Right. You know, unfortunately, that's one of the significant environmental threats for children as we begin the 21st century that's been there for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Don't kid yourself. It hasn't gone away. Mm-hmm. It's one that's been there before. It's not a new threat, but it is not vanished. Smoking is still real. I believe the statistics in this country are that 25% of Americans still smoke.
Something like that.
I could be wrong, so my apologies if I did make an error.
Well, except there have been some advances, because I remember being pregnant with our fourth son, coming on an airplane transatlantically, I guess, and at that point they had advanced to having a non-smoking section. Isn't that lovely? All the smoke is only going to stay
right
in the smoking section, which
right.
our seat was, of course, right behind. But clearly there was going to be a guard-all protective shield that was going to keep me from... And I spent the entire plane ride standing basically outside the bathroom.
Okay, I have a funnier story for you. I was on a flight once on a non-U.S. airline going overseas, and I still remember it was a 707, if any of you remember those specifically, and it was hysterical. The left side of the plane was smoking, the right side was not smoking, and I'm not making up
and
that
story.
And they were serious about that.
Yeah.
And the flight attendants admonished people on the wrong side of the plane for lighting up and asked them to move over. You're right, there have been advances, absolutely. However, on the other hand, we found out more. We've learned a lot more about secondhand smoke. And what we've learned is, I'll give you a couple of examples. Believe it or not, we have learned that the byproducts of smoke actually are passed in breast milk. Okay, we've learned that a woman who herself may not be a smoker, but who's nearby smokers or lives with a smoker or spends time in a smoking environment, that actually passes. We know more about the impact of secondhand smoke in kids than we did. Although we've made advances, we realize that the risks are even greater than we thought, and we can't give up our vigilance in this regard. So it's not a new threat, but it's a major one.
Mm-hmm. But I guess the global warming is something that really is on the horizon now that wasn't you know, 15 years ago or so.
Right. We're seeing it across the board. You've heard the predictions that the Arctic ice cap is not going to be frozen all year round anymore. We've all heard, and it's very real, about changes in the ozone layer. On one hand, environmental health is ultraviolet light and skin cancers, which are increasing. And in addition, all of the other protections that we have from the ozone layer as that breaks down can be very, very frightening. And that's frankly, looking at the three of us around this table, it's probably not going to affect the three of us in our lifetime, but in the lifetime of our children and those to come ahead of us. Which lets me circle this back to the last part of this before we get into maybe more specifics. Most of environmental health is not something that you see the effect of tomorrow or the next day or the day after that. If you feed your children, you see them grow. If your child, on the other hand, accidentally, heaven forbid, gets into an overdose of some medication or cleaner or whatever, you see the impact on that child, the danger, immediately as you rush him or her to the emergency room, right? Environmental exposures, with a few exceptions, don't affect a child today, tomorrow, or the next year. They affect that child when they're 30, when they're 50, or when they're 70. Our focus and our mindset becomes on an immediate gratification, on one hand, or in terms of the manufacturing industries and all of the plants that are around there, on what the measurable impacts today or tomorrow are, but not on what's happening way down the line. We have to think ahead, and that's the thing that people have to think about, is the future of the health of these kids, the future of the babies that they are going to deliver because they have been affected, the future of their health, that they will get significant illnesses later on in their life, and doing something about that now.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on kids and environmental hazards.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Ben Gitterman about environmental hazards to children.
What steps can we take as adults to lessen or eliminate any of these threats that we've been talking about?
One of the things that we can do is actually be politically active, in the sense of letting our elected officials know how important these issues are to us. Unfortunately, too often of late, environmental protections seem to be whittled away at, rather than increased in certain regards. We don't have to go into the specifics today, but just in general, it takes a public to demand of their elected officials that on the national as well as on the state and the local level, that our representatives really are working towards legislation that really increases protection, whether it be in terms of air pollution, whether it be in terms of the standards that we put into monitoring our environment, such as the water or the like, whether it means having the budget to be able to see that the monitoring of our water sources or the like on a day-to-day basis are not whittled away, whether it's seeing that certain things don't accidentally slip through because people aren't careful enough, like the lead issue in the water in D.C. that turned out, fortunately, to not be the catastrophe that people were afraid it was, but could have been an issue of great concern. We have to make our elected officials and our people in government very, very responsible to this issue, not just to the political climate of the day, so to speak. If I had to pick what adults could do in terms of that, that would be one of the most important things. The second thing that I would do is that adults would be working with their schools, with their child care centers, collaboratively, not only in their homes, to make sure that the environments the children are in all day long are safe ones for them. Most people are much more conscious about what goes on in their home than they were before. You made the perfect example of coming into the house, you know, and not bringing in the soil. But how many people really look to see what programs are in effect in a child's school? How many people look to see that those are not underfunded programs or not adequately careful? Yes, there is licensing, and yes, there are regulations. So that's probably one of the critical things that adults and parents can do. Another thing that we can really do is to really think about the food that we're giving a child. It's not only what we buy. People tell me,
we eat home-cooked meals. Mm-hmm. I say, sounds great. Home-cooked meals can have as many incredibly unhealthy things in them as going out. Is a home-cooked meal where you open a package, you throw it into the skillet, you add it to the microwave, and in 3 seconds it's done, and you really have no idea what you're giving your child, but you can clap your hands and you can say, well, we didn't go to the fast food chain today. We ate at home. It's a little bit more than that. Is it the pre-prepared pop-in-your-mouth thing that a child gets for breakfast? Does a family know what a child is getting from their food source in the middle of the day, at lunch, at daycare, at schools, et cetera, and so forth? What else can a parent do? Does a parent have to drive as much as they do? Can a parent foster a consciousness about this subject among their friends? People have book clubs. People have gardening clubs. Can people have organizations among their small local groups, not just joining the major obvious national ones like Greenpeace, but can they have small local activities that promote the environment in that regard? And most important, can we use the activities that we have as parents to instill in our children activities that they can be doing? Children can be encouraging education among themselves and among their younger peers in school. I've seen teen mentor groups or teen educational groups among young children. Parents can be encouraging schools to be teaching children about environmental hazards. Parents can be encouraging schools and other settings to have recycling programs, to be looking at energy-saving efforts. In some communities, they can be seeing that the schools are looking at what the heating system actually is to make sure that funds are put, that things aren't going to waste, that we're using up unnecessary environmental resources. Again, it becomes a tough issue for parents because there aren't the same concrete things that you see today that have an impact tomorrow. They have more of an impact down the line in terms of that. And more important, it's almost like epidemics. Parents can talk to other parents to see if there are patterns of things, patterns of health issues that children may be experiencing when they're in another setting that as individuals they're not aware of. When a school hears that one kid has a chronic cough, they don't think. But is it true that 50 kids in the school have a chronic cough and that in reality something may be going on in the school that the parent is not aware of? Okay? Parents can be encouraging municipalities to set regulations so that every street is not a highway, so that kids can get across places, so that children can be walking to school more. Okay? Parents can be encouraging, and so can kids, that there are more outdoor places for children to play. I get a little tired of parents telling me, oh, there's no one for this child to play with in their neighborhood, and there's nowhere for them to play. There are ways that we can create those spaces for kids so that parents aren't driving kids to places and that kids on one hand get exercise, but on the other hand are encouraging the fact that the local communities need to be developed in the right way, so that the environment is not overtaking the community, but rather people are living in their local environment. It's the overbuilt environment. Do we need to build up? Do we need to have these massive four-lane streets that a child can't even cross, that a child can't ride a bicycle on? Okay? Or do we have the opportunities for children to be out and playing because we're helping reduce those risks and hazards? This is part of environmental health.
Dr. Ben, what resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to learn more about some of the issues we've been addressing?
That's one of the ways where we've gone from that infancy to toddlerhood. There's a lot more information out there for parents. Some of it is practical. Some of it is what you can do in the smaller areas of particular exposures or toxicants or in the general area. There are several organizations that really can be very helpful. My biggest suggestion is not to arbitrarily go to the web. Let me give you the name of certainly some very fine, reputable, always not-for-profit organizations that parents can use. And rather than give you websites, it's easier to Google these things. Mm-hmm. First of all, the Environmental Protection Agency really has good information. The Children's Environmental Health Network has a lot of information that can be helpful for parents and for families and the like. The Children's Health Environmental Coalition, or CHECC, C-H-E-C, is another great organization that has a lot of information out there. The Pediatric Environmental Health Specialty Units, a different resource which is very valuable to parents. We currently call them the PESUs, set up with federal funds where the United States is now divided into 10 regions, and each one of those regions has a clinical center for education and direct clinical care for children who have potential pediatric environmental health-related issues. This is not only public health individuals, bureaucrats, or people in administrative positions. These are now clinical experts in pediatric environmental health, and each one of these centers covers a 5- or 6-state region, divvies up the country very nicely. These services are free. I would Google Pediatric Environmental Health Specialty Units. You also can look under the website of the Association of Occupational and Environmental Clinics, AOEC.
Would you repeat what the AOEC is?
Association of Occupational and Environmental Clinics. On their website, they have a direct link to the PESUs, or the Pediatric Environmental Health Specialty Units, as well. There are many, many, many resources out there. It's really changed. It's really wonderful. Unfortunately, there are inordinately frightening numbers of charlatans in this field. I can't tell you how many people go to individuals who make their decisions based on anecdotes, based on emotions, with no basis for the recommendations that they give to parents about mega-this therapy, about this nutritional support, for non-scientifically based information. I won't go beyond that except to say that the sources that I've recommended are evidence-based sources which are based upon the work, experience, and scientific knowledge of real clinicians and real scientists in this area.
Well, we have been so grateful for your opinions and your information and all the things that parents in need of better knowledge on this very important subject will be able to have. So, Dr. Ben Gitterman, thank you so very much for being with us again today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and mention show number 317. Again, that's 1-800-791-8573, and please spell anything in your name or mailing address that isn't obvious. Tell us what station you are listening to if you can. Our books are available in all major bookstores and on the web.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from the SF Foundation. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.